It's great to be back, and I'm glad to have all of you back. 333rd time we've sat down for this discussion. Welcome to the Parish of the Patriots. If you are new, I hope you'll listen to the whole show. We do have a Christian-specific segment. That's roughly the halfway point of the show. That'll come in. Very roughly the halfway point of the show, by the way. But I encourage you to give it a shot. If not, I do put it aside separately. So that's just absolutely you're not going to do it. Then you don't have to. I don't care. But I do encourage you to give it a shot. It is geared towards people who are already believers. It's not geared towards trying to convince a non-believer to accept the faith. It is geared towards those who are already believers to strengthen and help gain our knowledge in the faith. That's the point of it. You're not going to find something there that's geared to like some kindergarten level of, let me explain how Jesus loves you. You're not going to find that. Anyway, halfway point of the show. Check it out. Whatever. Or not. It's a whatever. It's there. You can check it out if you want or not. I don't care. If you do get something out of the show, don't be shy. Pay those tithes. We have snail mail here. It's pretty ridiculous. The rent on this P.O. box thing. I'm just about to get to that point of diminishing returns. Every year, it's jacking that shit up. This year, I just had to renew the rent on it. And I'm sitting there like, I'm doing the math. Like, is it even worth it? But it is. We'll do it at least. We'll leave it up there at least one more year. Drop something in the mailbox. That's what I got. The Bitcoin and whatever addresses you see on Radio Albion, those are Sven's. He left those. I don't have access to them. I don't have any. Don't know what's in there. Don't want to know. It ain't none of my business. Because it ain't mine. You got a snail mail. That's it. Don't be emailing me going, how can I support? I'd like to throw you a few bucks. That's it. There is no plan B. You can put something in an envelope. And it is very much appreciated. Now, this is the part where we get into the listener supporter mailbag. But did you... I didn't earn the P.O. box rent this week. There's nothing to tell. So we could just go ahead and keep on... go ahead, keep on trucking. It's all right. As you know... looking at my little notes, different things I jotted down. There's no script. That's clear. But I do jot things down from time to time. As you all well know, I'm loathe to talk about politics. I do. I just hate it. Hate it. And it's unavoidable because that's what's in the news, but it's pointless. One of the funny things, though, that have you noticed this? I call it the circle jerk delay tactic is what I call it. This thing I notice. It's a circle jerk. Circle jerk delay to try to keep people buying into the system. I find this a little encouraging because I think this probably points to their marketing research as showing that people throwing up their hands and saying, yeah, this whole system is a fraud. I don't know how many. They're never going to tell us. I think that's the reason they're having to crank up this circle jerkism. Circle jerkism. Liz Truss. You know, I had a lot of fun with Liz Truss. That didn't sound right. I had a lot of fun with Liz Truss. No. When Sven, before Sven's incarceration, you know, we did several shows and Liz Truss in her short term as prime minister in Britain and leading up to that. She was kind of a lol cow. And you know, she for very brief, very, very, maybe a record brief period of time, she was British. She was prime minister of the mighty British Empire. It didn't last long. Well, she's back attempting to be relevant. And now she's coming out talking about, oh, there's this group of people who want to change the fundamental nature of Britain and... What is the point of this? They're like paying a hooker for a hand job when you can do it yourself. Well, what is the point of saying, oh, there's a fundamental group. There's a group of people. They obviously, you'll notice this group of people will never be defined. Who want to change the fundamental makeup of Britain. Yeah, politician now suddenly discovering that, you know, while these British speech policies are a little repressive, on the one hand, they're always handle criminal migrants with kid gloves. And yet they set up special task force to patrol the internet to catch Britons who may be having the audacity of complaining about it. But then you have a politician, in this case, Liz Truss, and they come out and act like they've suddenly discovered this. Really? Imagine people coming out, a political figure, they come out and act like they've suddenly discovered that, hey, something's rotten in Denmark. Something's ludicrous in London. Of course, she hasn't just discovered this. This is just a new role. The circle jerk delay role. You see, this is, you're supposed to get the look at this. Because you see, like in Britain, we'll stick with Britain for our example. And I'm, you know, admittedly, I'm not like an expert on British politics. But the observable reality is the Labour Party didn't beat out the Tories this last time because everybody suddenly woke up one day and loved their policies. It's just that the people who were voting for the Tories realized that that was futile. There's just no point in voting. These people never do what they say they're going to do. So why bother? And enough of them finally hit critical mass, they quit bothering. And as a result, the Labour Party just won by default. But it wasn't because anybody loved Labour's policies. They're just sick of the Tories saying, hey, we're going to start shipping these people back out of here. We're going to stop the boats from coming. And of course, they never do. Well, where are the people who actually in the past do vote for Labour? Where are they at now? How pleased is the left with Keir Starmer? According to their own polls, which are no doubt are rigged, they're not very happy either. They've got to keep as many people as possible buying into this system while they run the clock out. It's so true when you hear the adage, you're not going to vote your way out of this. It's absolutely true. And if that is true, then the answer is, well, then what are you saying? Yeah, they always try, when you point that out, you're not going to vote your way. You're not going to change the system voting. You're not. I don't even know why that's considered a controversial. Well, I do, and we'll get to that here in just a minute. It's considered a controversial. When you say, you're not going to, it's true. You look at this mess that we live in, whether it's in Britain, the U.S., anywhere in Western Europe, take your pick. Nobody voted for this shit. People say, you voted for this. No, they didn't. People did not vote for this shit. We just got it anyway. There were people from a life, they go, you voted for this. People voted for this. They deserve it. People voted for this. And they themselves, when they make a statement, look, if you make a statement that people voted for this so they deserve it, then you are saying this system is legitimate, that it actually represents the will of the people. Think about what that means when you say, oh, well, people voted for this so they deserve to live in a shithole. They voted for these politicians so they deserve it. As if voting, you're actually saying that voting works. People are just voting the wrong way. You know? And when you say, when you observe this reality, it's not a controversial opinion. It's just an observable fact. The system does not have bugs in it. The system is not malfunctioning. It's operating as it's intended to. And continuing to buy into that system and vote and vote and vote and act like something's going to change when it never does, and it has not, at least not changed for the better. It's a reasonable conclusion to say you're not going to vote and change the decline, reverse the decline. Now, of course, when you state this obvious fact, this observable reality, what do they do? When someone makes the statement, you're going to vote your way out of this, they will turn around then and use that to insinuate, oh, So what you're saying is you should start go shooting people.
I see people out and out say that. You're like, oh, well, if people would grab their guns, they could change it.
How?
Every time you point the silliness out, they will, you know, people accuse you of, you know, cowardice. Oh, see, yeah, you don't want to do anything. You don't want to, how come nobody does anything? Of course, does anything that is always poorly defined. I wonder why that is. People would grab their guns. They could put a... Okay, grab your guns and do what? I mean, what are you going to do? You can't just wave them around. What are you going to do? If you're grabbing up your gun, I assume you plan to shoot somebody. Who are you going to shoot? Are you going to storm the Congress? That's going to take a large group of people. How far do you think you're going to get assembling a large group of people to storm the Congress and take over the government? How far do you think you're going to get in that plan before you get swooped? That's just reality. When you point out, when somebody makes a statement, you're not going to vote your way out of this. You're not going to vote your way and change this, reverse this course. The insinuation is made either outright or implied that you're going to go shoot random people or some shit, which is just silly. Because again, if you think that through, you know, how does that work? No, when you point out the reality, you're not going to vote your way out of this. You're not going to vote for change. So to answer that question, well, then what are you going to do? Well, for starters, quit voting. No, I mean, seriously. There is power in that. You know, if you realize that what you're doing is contributing to the problem, yes, stop doing that. That may not get you out of the hole that you're in, but at least the hole will cease to get deeper. Every vote is a vote for legitimacy of the system. Every time someone holds their nose and says, well, I'm voting for I read people. I was reading one particular writer here, back before the election. And this writer went on and on about Trump and how how he understood that Trump, Trump's shortcomings, Trump's tendency towards certain things. And have an article. This person would have an article basically admitting that probably not much is going to change. But then at the end of the day, they announce, I'm still going to go vote for Trump because it's going to be better than Harris. You're back to that lesser of two evils argument. And of course, like clockwork, this same person is now writing articles whining about Trump. You voted for this. Uh-oh, there I said it. You voted for legitimacy. Just don't vote. In America, I can't speak for in Europe or Britain, but in America, you know, there's like weird drum part of the programming we receive is that if you don't vote, then you don't have a right to complain. Your vote is your power. If you're not voting, then you're part of the problem. And of course, like everything else in this inverted satanic shithole, it's a lie. You're not voting is a vote against the system by default. When you say, I'm not participating in this anymore because it doesn't work. You strip legitimacy of the system. I've said this before. I will say it again. 99.99% of the people do not understand the importance of the system having legitimacy to stand. Because if you had an election, just hypothetically, if you had an election and like only 3% of the people bothered to vote, that system will collapse on itself. You cannot just rule by brute force. Well, you can for a short period of time. The system will implode on itself for a number of reasons I've articulated before, and I'm not going to sit here and rehash it for this point of this discussion. It has to have legitimacy. Why do you think now they're rolling out and doing this circle jerks tactic? Now, all of a sudden, Liz Truss has seen the light, and my gosh, we've got a problem in Britain. We have a lot of migrants there. No shit, bitch. You think? The Tories have suddenly seen the light. No, they haven't. They've looked at their internal polling data and said, oh shit, if we have an election today, the people who are voting for the Tories aren't going to show up. And now the few that were left voting for the Labour Party are going to show up. We could have a catastrophic election where nobody shows up. Remember that old bumper sticker slogan about imagine if they held a war and no one showed up? In other words, if the government declared war and everybody refused to join the military and said, no, I'm not going to fight, how would they have a war? It's the same thing. Imagine if they have an election and nobody shows up. Then what are they going to do? How are they going to pretend that they have the right to tell you what to do? And if it's obvious to one and all they don't, then why follow any of their rules? You can see why the system will start collapsing on itself. It's a delay tactic. They're headed to... This is where they're going with this. They just got to keep everybody buying into the system a little bit longer. I don't even know how people buy into this and pretend it's real. It always cracks me up when I read leftists bitching about Trump. You know, like they bitch about Trump and his Israel policy, especially concerning the Palestinians. Oh man, now that Trump's in, all these leftists, all these liberals, well, these Team D voters, they'll stand on the highest rock and denounce this savagery. Boy, Trump, MAGA, or whatnot. And it's virtually not different from the Biden administration. You know, it just cracks me up. If Kamala Harris was president, do you think America, the U.S.'s Israel policy, would be different at all? No, it wouldn't. At all. You would see virtually the same exact thing. Except the only thing that would change is the Team R people would be going, if Trump had gotten in there instead of Harris, he'd put Netanyahu in line. I think we're going to see continued efforts to this circle jerk. I think they're going to start presenting more and more politicians in these different Western democracy countries, you know, suddenly acting like, you know, they see the light. You know, get people to vote in, just get people to buy in. Suddenly you're going to recycle someone like Liz Truss, who suddenly realizes there's a migrant problem. Like, oh my gosh. It's like the British government is at war with its own people. This is a script. These people are handed a script and they're set out there. It's a circle jerk. It's a delay tactic. Circle jerk delay. Keep the people buying in a little longer. We're almost there. We're almost across the finish line. I mean, the native populations of these countries being intentionally displaced, that's not a theory. You know, anybody who claims that's a theory, conspiracy or otherwise, is just gaslighting. This is observed, intentional program at this point. And... you know, I don't even understand how it's considered controversial. You're just pointing out what it is. And then you have somebody come out and all of a sudden you're giving a politician who says they've suddenly discovered this. What are they going to do? But Trump is doing it. He's deporting all of these people. We don't have any actual numbers, by the way. I mean, I see all kinds of different numbers thrown out there, but we have no way of verifying that. What you'd have are some video footage of people being swooped, you know, swooping in. ICE is swooping in. But how many people are actually, I don't know. Maybe part, I don't know. I know I'm cynical. I do because it's experience. it's experience. You know, they put these videos out. You get these videos and these ICE agents are swooping in on some random guy. Boy, he's going to get deported. And, you know, the Team Trump people will sit there and cheer that and say, see, he's finally doing it. He's getting these people out of the country. You know, he never built the wall. I mean, that didn't happen either. And yet this is real because you saw a video and one guy got thrown in a van. What I see, and again, maybe this is just me being cynical. What I see, I find disturbing because I see context and I see a bigger picture. Not bragging on myself. Y'all probably do the same. You know, I don't sit here and cheer it when I see one guy get swept on by a dozen ICE agents. And I go, yeah, get the brown people out of the country. Because what I see is you got these federal troops now operating on the streets of America. And I say troops because that's how they're dressed up. They're dressed up like they're military. More disturbing, have you noticed they all have these bandanas and shit over their face? You know, they're wearing masks and bandanas and covering their identity. How do you look at, look, it's the same government. I don't care if there's a Trump in there or whoever. It's the same entity. That doesn't change. How do you look at federal troops now on the ground wearing masks over their heads, stuffing people in a van, and you say, this is great. Finally, we're making America great again. Add to that the context where Trump has talked about, oh, we need to basically, in not so many words, he has basically said, we need to do this to anti-Semites in this country. I don't know, man. You know, how do you look at this? And you got federal people wearing masks, swooping some random dude, one guy, shoving him in a van. Yeah. Will you be cheering when it's your ass getting shoved in the van because you're an anti-Semite or you spoke against the government or you complained about the Federal Reserve or whatever the hell? You just don't love America enough. So in the van you go. When Trump is replaced by the Team D candidate or whatever the hell, and everything keeps going the same direction, and now the precedent is set, and so now the masked federal troops are rounding up you bad thinkers for your Twitter posts and shoving you in a freaking van. And they can sit there and cheer. The same people that were outraged when Trump had masked goons shoving a guy in a van, they were outraged. When the script flips and it's your dumb ass being shoved in a van, those same people that were, oh, complaining about Trump doing it will cheer it on. Get the evil haters. Get the Nazis. Get them all out of here. Put them in alligator Alcatraz. Yes, I'm cynical. I have experience. I've just seen this. I see the way it's working. Repatriating people to their home countries does not take gooning up guys in military gears, wearing masks, carrying automatic weapons with them for a video to swoop one dude off the street. You got millions of people in the country. If you're going to deport them one person at a time with masked goons on video, you're not going to make much progress. That's just plain and simple. You know, it's like if you were going to remove, you went out there and you got a big ant den in your yard and you look out there and you got, my gosh, I got all these ants in my yard. Look at that huge ant den in my yard. And so you wanted to remove the ant den. And so you go out there with a pair of tweezers and pick one ant up at a time. Your neighbors would laugh at you, be like, what are you doing? Well, I'm getting rid of them. I'm deporting these ants. One at a time with my tweezers. People are going to laugh at you because you ain't never going to get anywhere with that. That's just silly. That's just a photo op. That's just some bullshit for the cameras to keep people buying in, to keep the circle jerk going. I don't know, man. You know, I don't like it. I don't. And you see these federal goon troops out on the streets wearing masks over their face, shoving some guy that they're telling you is an illegal immigrant. Maybe he is, maybe he's not. How do we know? They're just telling us that. Shoving him into the van. I saw a video, a cop video, and the federal agent comes over to local cops and joke about, yeah, we're kidnapping him. You know, if they can kidnap him, they're going to kidnap you one of these days. It's just... And they keep it going. They got to keep it going. They got to keep people buying in. That's why I laugh at these people that buy into it and they cheer. They think their team is winning. Look at that. The illegals are getting it now. Look at that. One guy got shoved in a van by these masked up, geared up goons. And then the Team D cheerleaders can sit around and virtue signal about how outraged they are at this violation of these people's rights. And in another 4 years, if a Team D stand-in is in office and they're shoving bad thinkers into the van for their social media posts or whatever, those same people cheer it on. They just keep cheering it on. You can say what you want, but one thing you can't say. You can't say I voted for any of this shit. When whatever candidate... And look, like I said, it's so silly to me to see these Democrat supporters, these Team D cheerleaders, and they act like this whole Gaza thing just started with Trump. It's like I've said before, you know, I watched some of these videos, you know, demonstrating like literal retarded behavior by local police somewhere, you know, and you have people in the comments, this is what you get when you vote for Trump. Like, this just started 6 months ago. I don't know, man. People complain about Trump, his Israel policy, like it was any different last year at this time. You know, how was the Biden administration's policies any different concerning Israel than Trump's? But alas, you can't point that out. You could wind up getting deported in a van or some shit. Go to Alligator Alcatraz. I don't know. What I do know is we need to go ahead and, we're not going to, look, don't buy into this. They're doing this now, all of a sudden you're going to have, you got these politicians coming out. They regen them, recirculate them. All of a sudden they have a new image and they come out and they're talking about, I've said this before, I need to get into the Christian specific segment, but I've said this before, when you do a podcast or any kind of commentary, one thing you learn really quickly, one of the first lessons you have to learn is that people don't care about what you're saying. They don't want your opinions. What they want to hear is their opinions coming out of your mouth. You know, and then that way, when you get pushback from the audience and people, you say things people don't like, you got to get a thick skin for that because people just want to hear their own opinions coming out of your mouth. And when you fail to do that, sometimes people get upset. You know, that just, they take advantage of that dynamic is what I'm saying. When they regen someone, like we were talking about Liz Truss, when they reinvent a character for a politician or whatever, they take advantage of that. They bring somebody out. And they have them speak. They know what the people say, act like these politicians are out of touch. No, they're not. They know exactly what you think. They just they're trying to find a way to keep you going along with it. They know what you think. They're not out of touch. They absolutely know that you don't like anything they're doing. Do you think any of these politicians don't understand that so many of the American people or whatever in Europe or whatever country you want to pick don't support their nation's pro-Israel policies? You think they don't know? They know. They just got to keep gaslighting you to keep you buying into the system. They take advantage. What I want to say is they take advantage of that dynamic. They know that you don't care about their opinions. You just want to hear their opinions coming out of their mouth. That's why someone like Liz Truss can come out and then start talking about, wow, it's like there's a group of people controlling the British government that have this set way that they want to do things in this direction. They want to steer the country. And that gets you bought back in. They take advantage that you want to hear them saying your thoughts coming out of their mouth. All they got to do, it doesn't matter who it is. Doesn't matter how hypocritical it is, how cynical it is, they'll set somebody out there and have them speak your opinion. All they got to do is put this politician out there and have them say what they already know you think. Again, they know what you think. It's not a mystery. They know. So they just got to present a character playing a role, and that's all these people are. They're actors. They have to put them out there All they have to do is put them out there. It doesn't matter what their past record is. It does not matter. They can get the most ludicrous, ridiculous person, put them out there, and as long as they'll say your opinion's coming out of their mouth, you'll buy into it. I'm not saying you specifically, but you know, people in general. That's all they got to do. They say, okay, people are dissatisfied. They're starting to not buy into this system for this reason. All they got to do is stick this actor out there and have him say what you're thinking, your opinions coming out of his mouth, and you'll vote for him. Doesn't matter what he's done in the past. Doesn't matter that's never worked before. It's never going to work. It doesn't matter. People will buy right back in as soon as they hear some political figure saying what they think coming out of their mouth. Doesn't matter that they've never done that before. How did they suddenly just now see the light? Was there not a migrant problem in Britain when Liz Truss was prime minister? I know it didn't last for long, but I'm pretty sure it was still an issue back then. See, it doesn't matter. All they got to do is set an actor out there, have them say what you are saying, what their polling data says. This is what the people are saying. This is what they think. All they got to do is have them stand up there. It doesn't matter how absurd and ludicrous. In fact, I think they get off on it being absurd and ludicrous because it just reaffirms their view of how freaking stupid people are. All they got to do is put an actor out there, have them say your opinions out of their mouth. And the vast, vast majority of people will buy into it every single time. We're going to get into the Christian specific segment. I can tell it now. We're going to run long. It's going to be worth the ride. You know what to do. Get in there. Fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon at the Parish of the Patriots. The 113th Psalm is real short. I want to read it real quick, and then we'll get into what all I thought we would discuss today. And I actually got quite a few things I'm hoping we get to. We probably won't get to all of them, but we're going to do our best. So the 113th Psalm reads, "Praise ye the Lord. Praise, O ye servants of the Lord. Praise the name of the Lord. Blessed be the name of the Lord from this time forth forevermore. From the rising of the sun unto the going down of the same, the Lord's name is to be praised. The Lord is high above all nations, his glory above the heavens. Who is like unto the Lord our God, who dwelleth on high? Who can humble himself to behold the things that are in heaven and in the earth? He raiseth up the poor out of the dust, and lifteth the needy out of the dunghill, that he may set him with princes, even with the princes of his people. He maketh the barren woman to keep house, and to be a joyful mother of children. Praise ye the Lord." One of the things that made me pick that psalm to start off with is that last part where he lifts up the poor, he lifts up the needy out of the dunghill. He uses the lesser things. And we see this pattern over and over in the Bible. And I thought we'd look at it and think about it, and like I say, maybe expand out some other things as to why God does that. Because it is an obvious pattern that the Lord uses the unlearned. He uses those who don't come from, you know, a prestigious background. Jesus, his disciples, they're like fishermen. They were regular people instead of people with a staunch religious background. That's not to say he never uses people with more of a background. But you see this regular pattern through the Bible that the Lord uses the lesser to his glory. And again, why is that? And, you know, I thought that'd be interesting to get into. I think a really good example of one of the reasons maybe God does this is because when God brings up the lesser, and he raises the poor out of the dung heap, as we just read, when he brings up the lesser, you can't claim it was man's doing. When he brings up a nobody and raises him to position or uses him to spread his word or to spread his wisdom, you can't, that person or name, nor anybody else can say, well, that guy was just really smart. You know, that guy had it going on. On the flip side of that, if you do use somebody with a prestigious background and whatnot, there's always going to be that temptation to glorify yourself. We're going to get into that a little bit. I think a really good example of this is comparing King David to Solomon, his heir. Now, David, he was a nobody. The first king for the actual nation state of Israel was Saul. And poor Saul, bless his heart. It's always been my impression that Saul was just nuts. Now, maybe he was a little bit off to begin with, but I think the pressures of being the king and the leadership and all that stuff bearing down on him, it just broke him. I think he was just literally, when you read about his different mood swings and all the stuff that was going on, the guy was nuts, and it showed. But after Saul, you had King David. Now, David was a nobody. He was the runt of the litter. He was such a nobody that when the prophet told his father, one of your sons is going to be the next king of Israel, so bring him in so I can put my hands on him and tell you which one is going to be. He didn't even bother bringing David because he's run of the litter. He was just like, somebody's got to watch the sheep. So we'll leave David out there because it can't be him. It's got to be one of the other brothers, one of his brothers. So he just got completely overlooked because he was like nobody. Nobody would look at this runt and say, well, he's going to be a great warrior king someday. The thought would have been laughable. And yet this nobody, this runt of the litter kid that got left out with the sheep, rose up. God rose him up to be the greatest king of the nation state of Israel. Yes, he made his mistakes and he paid for those. He repented of those. That just shows his humanity. One of the things I think really points to the truthfulness in the Bible is how it lays bare the ugliness, the ugly side, the sin that David committed. In other words, we always talk, we look around the world today in our recent modern history, and we often say, the victors write the history. And as such, the failings and whatnot of their leaders, of the victor, the leaders of the victors, it tends to get whitewashed. They just cover that up. We need a national hero. We can't look down on his failings. And yet in the Bible, it's all laid out to bear. David's sin and where he went astray, and ultimately, it caused turmoil and he overcame it. I think that really points to so much of the truth of the Bible, is that this isn't covered up. It's actually talked about. It's looked at, examined, and the process that he went through. But I think, hands down, David was unarguably the greatest king of the ancient nation state of Israel. Now, after David came Solomon. And Solomon was a mess. Yes, he was blessed with great wisdom. He was born into royalty, and he was blessed with great wisdom. God gave him wisdom. He gave him a peaceful reign. David wanted to build God's temple. He couldn't build it. The Lord told him, no, you've shed blood. You're a warrior king, basically. You're not going to be able to build the temple, but your son will. And as a part of that, Solomon was blessed with peace during his realm. He was blessed with wisdom. He had everything handed to him. And it wasn't exactly the greatest outcome. In fact, I think you could point to Solomon as the beginning of the end for ancient Israel. He was indeed wise. He was so wise that people came, leaders, kings, queens, they came from all over the world just to sit and listen to the guy talk because he had so much wisdom. He was blessed with a time of peace. In all of this almost infinite wealth stored up, there's gold and silver everywhere. He really was just, and he came up in royalty and he was handed all of this prosperity. And yet, what does he wind up doing? He winds up marrying foreign women as a part of it, which as a royal, you know, that's how you signed treaties back in those. You took the daughter of these foreigners as your wives, and that is, that was now we're kin, so we won't break the treaty. And of course, he brought them in and allowed them to bring their false gods in. And he had a bunch of them, not just one or two. He had a whole bunch of them. And this introduced more idolatry into Israel. I think his wisdom was so great that he started thinking, I mean, you know, you think about it. You're so wise and you're so profound that people from all over the world come just to listen to you talk. Pretty easy to get full of yourself and start forgetting the admonitions and the warnings of the Lord against certain things. Keeping this in the context of why does God have this pattern of using lesser things? A slave, once set free, will cherish each and every day of his freedom. Well, a slave that has known nothing but slavery and servitude his entire life, once he is set free, every day that he wakes up a free man, you know, whatever his circumstances, good, bad, in between, the first thing he savors when he wakes up in the morning is his freedom. Where, on the other hand, the man who's born into freedom simply takes it for granted. David came up out of nothing, so he was very much aware that this was God moving in his life. This was God blessing what he was doing and lifting him up. He knew he was nobody. Solomon was born into it and always praised for his great wisdom. I think it works a lot the same way in our faith. You know, the more things we've overcome in our lives to come to Jesus, the more we appreciate the freedom and the spirit that we have in the Lord, the more we appreciate what he's done for us. When we look at ourselves, which is a constant ongoing thing in our faith, when we look at ourselves, we can't look away from the things we've done. We know our own sin and our own hearts. We're looking at those things and we're aware. So no matter what God accomplishes in our own lives, we know it's from him. It keeps us from conceit because we know where we came from. We know the things we've done. Don't get all full of yourself. We know from whom came our deliverance. Again, the slave, once set free, cherishes each day of his freedom. Where the man who's born into freedom he just takes it for granted. That's just normal for him. Now, when we talk about Jesus, as we know, Jesus overcame death. We talk about it. It's a central part of our faith. Jesus rose from the dead. What does that mean? What does it mean to say Jesus overcame death? Well, yes, he rose from the dead. But when you think about it, what does that entail? Well, he was executed and he stepped out of the temporal realm into the eternal realm, where time doesn't exist. Remember, time is what keeps us here. This is time is what defines where we live, this realm. He stepped out of that when he died. You're going to do the same. I'm going to do the same. Everybody you know, your family, loved ones, whatever, who have passed on, they did that. In a sense, this is nothing remarkable. It is remarkable in that God established it, but it's nothing remarkable because we're all going to do that. The minute you die, this body is what keeps you bound to the temporal realm. Once you die, you're going to step out of that temporal realm. So Jesus doing this is the same thing that each and every one of us will do when we leave this world, when we pass on. Now, what makes it remarkable is that Jesus stepped back in. You see, he died. He stepped out of the temporal realm. We will all do that when we die. The difference is you or I, we're not stepping back in. Unless for some reason God tells us to, but generally speaking, setting aside, you know, God can do all things, we can't go back in. We can't go back and forth in the temporal realm to the eternal realm. Jesus when we say he rose from the dead, what that means is he stepped out of the temporal realm into the eternal realm. But then he stepped back in when he appeared to the disciples. He stepped from the eternal back into the temporal. In other words, he could go back and forth. It was up to, he would appear. He appears to the women. He appears to the disciples. He appears again to the disciples, walking along the road, sitting around the campfire. He shows up. He steps in and he steps out. This is what it means that death has no power over him, because he can step freely from the temporal. This shows the divine nature of Christ. He can step out of the temporal realm and he can step back in at will. This is what it means. Death has no power over him. We die, we go to the eternal realm, and that's it. We're not coming back. We're not going, we're not being reincarnated. We're not stepping back. We're not going to come back and warn people. We're not going in and out. It's a one-way trip. When the baby is born from its mother's womb, it can't crawl back in there. It's a one-way trip. Once you're expelled from the womb, your life in this world begins. That's how it is for us. When we're expelled from this lifetime womb where we're supposed to be spiritually maturing, and we're birthed into the real life, into the eternal realm, with whatever amount of maturity we've managed to accumulate while in the womb, that's it. We can't crawl back into the temporal realm. We wouldn't want to anyway. But you can't. No more than a baby could crawl back into its mother's womb once birthed. It's a one-way trip, but not for Jesus. Jesus went to the eternal realm. And then multiple times stepped back into the temporal realm to tell people stuff, to appear before the disciples, to go ahead and leave some last-minute instructions. This is what you're supposed to do, to help them clean up their baggage, to get their house in order so they could start down the path that he had given them to do, to carry out the work, to carry on the legacy. He step in, he step. This is what it means. Death has no power over him, because he can go into the eternal realm. He can come back. There's no, the barrier, the wall there has no effect on him. He's truly overcome it. Now, as I said, we're kind of moving from one topic to another, because I just had several things over the past week that I jotted down and I thought they'd be interesting to get to. So we're kind of moving from one theme to another. I'm doing my best to kind of tie them together, but I don't know how well that's working. I don't know how well that's working out. But moving on to the next thing, I was thinking about the difference. When you consider the difference in rebellion, sin, between that of a man and that of a woman, because there is a difference. I believe there is a difference in the fundamental nature of the sin and the reasons behind it. You know, between that of a man and that of a woman. Now, what started me on this train of thought the other day, I was thinking about how it sucks for the it sucks for the unbeliever, because, you know, there's no, the life is just so pointless. You know, I feel sorry for them. I really do, because this whole thing is meaningless. Imagine believing you came from monkeys and you're just here by pure happenstance on this rock, which is hurling around in outer space, waiting. Maybe aliens will show up or something. And everything that happens just happens. There's no reason, rhyme, design, or anything to it. I'm not going to bother picking that all apart. We've done that before, and it's honestly so obvious that it seems silly that people are deceived in such a manner. But imagine believing that and having that mindset and the pointlessness of it all. As believers, I think we do. I think we take it for granted a little bit, you know, the having meaning in our lives. You know, even when we go through sufferings and trials and things we have to overcome, because we know that this is temporary and we understand that we're here and why we're here and that these are things we have to overcome as a part of our maturity, it makes it so much easier to soldier through that.
Now, I'm sure those people claim to you just have to have that to cope with that. You're just coping with that.
But it's not. It is just recognizing the point of it all, the good and the bad. We understand as believers, you know, when we have nobody wants to go through hard times and suffering. Nobody, not me, not you, not anybody. But we do understand the temporal nature of it. And when we're having good times and everything's going our way and things are peaceful and we got plenty of money in the bank, whatever. We also, in the back of our minds, understand to enjoy it to our full. It makes it easier, in other words, for us to enjoy that because we know it's temporary. We cherish it. We relish it because we know that bad days are also coming. Loss, suffering, you know, hard times. Those things are coming too. We know they're coming. So it makes it easier to actually cherish and relish those good times when they come around. Also, it makes it easier to overcome those hard times because we're reminded that just as the good times are temporary, so are the hard times. The unbeliever has good times and he has to just hope that that goes on forever, which of course it's not. It's inevitably going to end. And then they come crashing down. I do. I feel sorry for these people. I don't know how they make it through life. But thinking that this whole exercise is pointless. In other words, there's no meaning to life. So where do you try to find it? And this brings us to the fundamental nature, I think, of where a man sins, where he misses the mark. You see, I believe the sin of men, of man, talking specifically about men here, not mankind, but men themselves. I believe men's sin can be boiled down to or simplified down to a misplay, to trying to find meaning in life in the wrong place. A misplaced meaning, if you would. They're trying to find, a man is trying to find, a man is driven to find some sort of meaning in his existence, a meaning in his life. Men have, for time immemorial, men have said, you know, what is the meaning of life? You know, this is probably the most fundamental philosophical question. What is the meaning of life? As believers, we already know that answer. We got that. We got it whipped because we already have that fundamental answer or fundamental question rather answered. But so many don't. A man asks, what is the meaning of life? And this, I believe, is where man's sin tends to be centered around a misplaced trying to find a meaning in life in something. It usually turns up into some form of pleasures, trying to find some form of pleasure and making that the meaning of your life. And it'll always come up empty, whether it's sex, money, materialism, you know, all these different forms of hedonism. At the fundamental core of it, I believe it's a misplaced, It's a case of misplaced, finding a misplaced meaning in life. You go chasing after these things, trying to find some sort of meaning, some sort of identity, some sort of meaning, some sort of reason why you get up every day, why you're here. What's the meaning of life? I often point to these people who have all this money and all this power and they have more money than they're ever going to be able to spend their entire lives. And yet, you know, they'll practically knife a homeless person to take his $1. You know, they go to this extreme for more. It's never enough. They never sit back and go, well, I'm old now. I probably don't have that many years left. I have more money than myself, my kids or my grandkids are ever going to spend in their lifetime. I think I'll chill out. They never chill out, do they? They just always push for more. It's insanity. And it's that, I believe that's because they're still trying to find that. That's their false god. That's their false meaning they have found in their lives. You know, having money and power. This is their made up, misplaced meaning in life. They can't. That's why they can't give it up. They can't sit there and where common sense would tell you, well, if you're a kajillionaire, you know, what keeps you getting up every day and trying to find new ways to screw the people out of money, to accumulate even more power, wealth? You have more than you or next three generations are ever going to be able to spend. Why are you, what drives you to do it? And it's because that's their meaning in life. It's a false one. It's a false God. It's a false meaning. But that is the misplaced meaning they've created in their lives. Now, that's just an obvious and easy example. But I do. I believe man's sin and rebellion is usually centered around some form of trying to find meaning in life outside of the Lord. And there is none. It leads to madness. You know, you see people, and you know, because obviously not everybody can be rich and powerful. But you see, even among regular people, even among poor people, they'll create these misplaced meanings, this made up meaning in life, and they'll pursue it, even if it's self-destructive. Even if it's too obviously to everybody, they're pursuing something to their own detriment. When people create an identity for themselves, they're creating a meaning in their life. Again, a false one. You know, this is who I am. And it leads to madness. It leads to, it can be self-destructive. It doesn't matter because they've created this. This is their identity. In other words, this is their meaning in life, and it's misplaced. Now, when we look over here, I believe a woman's sin, a woman's rebellion, is completely different. I believe the fundamental nature of the way a woman sins and the reason behind it is different. Where man's sin, a man's rebellion, is centered around a misplaced trying to find a meaning in life. I believe a woman's rebellion is more fundamental. It's more personal. A woman is literally rebelling against the father. You think of the stereotype, you know, of you see a stripper and, you know, you know she has daddy issues. I believe a woman's rebellion basically can be boiled down in its essence to daddy issues. It's a direct rebellion against the father. These can stem from her own upbringing or for whatever reason, but it's of a more personal nature. I believe a woman who has daddy issues, as they say, her earthly father, her dad, in a lot of ways stands in as a proxy for God. And she rebels and does everything she can to basically to damage him as a proxy to the Lord. Where a man's rebellion, a man's sin, an attempt to find all these misplaced meanings for his existence, instead of humbling himself and acknowledging, you know, the true meaning of why he's here and acknowledging God the Father, the Creator. You know, in other words, a man can have a diverse amount of misplaced meaning. It can take the form of just about anything. It can be sexual in nature. There are men who will try to find their meaning in life by how many women they sleep with, you know, or homosexuality, whatever. These things turn in, they are these misplaced meanings, and it can take all sorts of form, money, women, whatever. A woman's rebellion would normally be sexual in nature. I mean, it may not appear it on the surface, but it is. It would primarily be sexual in nature because this gets down to the fundamental nature of women, their role in this world. They are the key element in child rearing. I was just reading a little story today that they're having a birth rate problem in China, of all places, you know, a place with all these people. And I was reading all of these stupid reasons they're giving, you know, incorrect reasons they're giving for why China now has a birth rate problem. And, you know, finally you get in there and it's like, well, women have changed their attitudes about their role in society. Ping pong. You can take all the other reasoning they're giving and throw that out. See, when a woman renounces her primary role, her key, one of her key meanings in life, why she's here, her key role of being able to create further generations so that the lineage continues, and closes up her womb voluntarily. You see, this is kind of an ultimate rebellion. God put her here. One of her key roles is to be able to further mankind. And she says, no, Daddy, I'm not doing that. I find it amazing when you look back in older times, you know, in biblical times and whatnot, you know, a woman who was barren was a tragic figure. It was looked upon as a tragedy when a woman was just simply incapable of childbirth. It was considered a very sad thing, a very sorrowful and mournful thing that she could not have children. And you fast forward to today, and women intentionally sterilize themselves. They're not barren. They take drugs to make themselves barren. Make that make sense. What greater example of a woman in rebellion is there than a loose woman? Men will point out and talk about, you know, loose women. It's a tactful way of putting it. I've heard people say, you know, that's somebody's daughter. You need to respect her, even if she is a whore, because that's some man's daughter. In rebellion, men say, "Boy, I love loose women because, you know, easy access to sex." But you got to beware of loose women, because do you want to play a role in her rebellion against God? Remember, her rebellion against her daddy. Her daddy is a stand, and he's a proxy for the father. It's ultimately, in other words, it's ultimately a rebellion against God. Daddy is just he's just a proxy. He's just a stand-in. He's just what she can point to. But ultimately, the rebellion is against the father. This is, I think, the fundamental difference. Like I say, men sin in trying to find a misplaced meaning in life. This is why they pursue all of these different lunatic things or whatever. They're trying to find a meaning in life. Where a woman, it's much more personal in nature. It is rebellion against daddy. It is rebellion against the father. I can't imagine, you know, a much more tragic thing than to be a father, have a daughter. You spend years raising her up. She's your pride and joy. And you finally get her grown, and she's a whore. You know, she's a skank. You know, how heartbreaking is that? And why would a woman choose to do that? Well, because it's rebellion. It's rebellion against that. I'm just to hurt him. You know, to use that power to hurt her father and ultimately rebel against the father. Now, we talk about this. So what good does it do to know this? Okay, that's all well and good, but we're reeling things back to ourselves, to believers. What good does it do us to know this? Because when we understand the fundamental nature of the reason why people sin in the way they do, and when you get down to the essence of what it is, even when these things get to the extreme of madness, then you can't help but to recognize that this fallen world we live in, this society that we live in, encourages this. Look at this world around us, and then we understand if a man's rebellion at its fundamental nature is that of pursuing misplaced meaning in life, and a woman's is on a personal rebellion against the father, is there anything, what does this society encourage? Does it not encourage this in every aspect? What are women told? Get on the pill as early as you can and start banging as many guys as you can. This is freedom. You see, the rebellion is encouraged. Same thing with men. Your meaning in life is how much money do you got? You know, what kind of car do you drive? How many people are impressed who you are? I always say, you know, when you say, what's a man's, you know, what's he worth? Oh, well, people will immediately spout off how much money they think he has in the bank. That's what he's worth. Everything in this society is intentionally structured to encourage rebellion. Point to something in our society in general, in this world in general, that discourages any of what we've just talked about. You're going to be hard-pressed to find it. What part of our society encourages women to honor their father and to be chaste, to respect themselves, and to carry out their role? Go in and talk to young women and say, you know, are you looking forward to have, how many children do you hope to have? And are you looking forward to a life of joy and raising children and seeing your grandchildren? Oh, no. I'm going to go do this and have a meaningless career. And I've got to go to college and have my fun stage and get railed on by all these different dudes. Everything in the society encourages that. You see, and then you understand the fallen nature of this world. We understand the different reasons that men sin and women sin and the different nature of it. And then you look, and just by pure coincidence, and this increases our faith because, again, we see the spiritual nature of things. You can't help but to notice that by pure coincidence, everything, virtually everything in this society is structured to encourage this very self-destructive behavior that we've described, that we've looked at here. Everything. That's not... If it was coincidence, some of it might, but then some of it would also discourage it. Kind of weird that there's nothing in place to discourage. Virtually everything in the society around us encourages this, whether it appeals to the fundamental sinful nature of man or women, the rebellious nature of man or woman. Virtually everything in this society is to encourage the absolute worst in people. If somebody is trying to do the right thing, everything in this society is designed, the narratives, what people are told their entire lives, virtually everything is structured to send them in that direction. Go find meaning in materialism. Go find meaning in hedonism. You know, show daddy how independent you are by how many different dudes you sleep with. Everything in this society is structured. That's not coincidence. If this is just happenstance, then some of it might encourage that. But then there would be other things that said, no, don't do that. Virtually everything in this society encourages the worst. How do you make sense of that? How do you explain that as pure coincidence? As pure happenstance, it just happened to work out that way, that virtually everything in the society you live in encourages people to the most self-destructive and rebellious path they can take. It's a plan. You know, it is. This isn't coincidence. People are intentionally steered to a path of destruction in the society. Everything in the society, virtually everything in the society, is geared to push people. Think of how easy it is to just go along. If you just went along with the flow of the narratives that this society tells you of how you're supposed to live your life from a young age through your whole life, you would just be carried along like swept down a river. There's just the path of least resistance. Just do what the society encourages you to do. And where are you going to wind up? You're going to wind up at the same place all these other people, on the highway to hell. Think of what a labor it is in your faith to swim against that current, to do what is right. Every day you get up as a believer and live your life the way you're supposed to, you are swimming against the current. You're swimming against the narrative of this society, because everything in this society is telling people to just go to hell. You know, chase your pleasure. Today is it. There's no meaning. Why is that? Who's telling people that? Where does this false narrative come from? Remember this as you get, for those times when you get tired, when you get exhausted swimming against the current. And stop and ask yourself, why is the current this way? Why is it that the narrative, everything around us is saying, no, 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 this is what you got to do. And you see all these people being swept off. And know that, you know, this is why you're here. This, your effort that you're putting in to swim against that current is not in vain. Instead, the vanity lies in these narratives, in this rebellion against God. Anyway, we'll wrap up on that. I hope you got something out of it. It can be tiring to be going against the flow every day. As believers, this is what we face. This is a part of that process is every day you're swimming against the current. And look, it does. It gets tiring. It gets tiring for everybody. But when you understand there's a reason it's structured this way, all of that influence, all that constantly encouraging people to destruction, that comes from the devil. That is Satan's narrative. And sadly, a lot of people, I would say probably most people, are caught up in it. So yeah, it may be exhausting to swim against that current, but when you consider the alternative, it's more than well worth the effort. We'll wrap up on that note. I appreciate you stopping by today. Again, I hope you got something out of it. And if so, hopefully I'll see you here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.